astonishing collaboration between the Philadelphia Orchestra Eugene Ormandy, Franz Liszt, and Cyprian Katsaris. That's the Fantasia on Hungarian folk themes for piano and orchestra. And it is such a pleasure to be here with you and with Cyprian Katsaris. Thank you for coming.
I thank you, Kathy, for the kind invitation. I'm very moved to be here with you in such a prestigious city, Boston, considering the history musically. It's a great pleasure and honor for me. And, you know, this meeting with Mr. Ormandy 26 or 25 years ago or so was quite something. This recording, which was made for EMI, Angel, and which we just got recently the license from them on my little label, Piano 21, was quite an experience because when I met Mr. Ormandy, I told him, Maestro, I'm very intimidated. You know, he asked me to come to his place and rehearse the three pieces which are on the CD, on the recording, one day only before the recording happened. And I told him that I was intimidated, and he says, oh, you know, my young friend, when I was a young conductor and they told me that I was going to accompany Rachmaninoff, you know, that he recorded his piano concertos with Rachmaninoff, most of them. I was also so intimidated, and I remember this first performance where he was playing his Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini. During the concert, Rachmaninoff changed the notes. And I looked at him while I was conducting, and I was frightened because he was very tall. He had this big, long face, and he looked at me angry, and he just said while he was playing, play. So I thought that I messed up with the orchestra, and at the end of the concert, I went to see him and to apologize, and he said, no, it's not your fault. It was my fault because I just had a memory problem and I started improvising. And then I felt better.
You know? What a great story.
And Ormandy, as you know, Eugene Ormandy was a Hungarian. So this Hungarian Fantasy, which has been the very first piece I played in a concert when I was a student in Paris at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, was a shock for me. When I heard it just a few years before, played in the same hall by Cifra, the great Hungarian pianist Gheorghe Cifra, who unfortunately is not as famous as he should have been in this country, which only had admiration for Horowitz. Of course, Horowitz was a great musician, a great pianist, but Cifra was also a great musician, also a great pianist. And excuse me to say that pianistically, purely pianistically, Cifra was much superior than Horowitz. If you compare the scores of his arrangements, like The Flight of the Bumblebee, for example, with any arrangement of Horowitz, I personally believe that pianistically it's much more difficult, although we are not always looking for the most difficult piece. But it is unfair that he was so underrated in this country.
When you were at this concert and Cifra was there, how old were you?
When I heard Cifra the first time live, he played the Hungarian Fantasy and the first piano concerto of Liszt. It was, I think, in 62. I was 11 years old. And then when I met him, when I played at his competition in 1974 in Versailles, I asked him the score of The Flight of the Bumblebee, which for me was a mystery. How is it possible to play like this? You know, I had this LP with all his paraphrases and transcriptions, and I couldn't understand how it's possible. So he said to me, you know, he was a very humble man, by the way. He was very humble, very simple, very, very generous person, good heart person. When you met him, you know, you wouldn't imagine that he was such a great pianist. He said, I never wrote it down because I was improvising all this stuff. And then he had the idea to ask his son, who was a wonderful conductor, with whom I played Tchaikovsky number one at the competition. He asked Georgie Jr., to write it down using a special recording machine which could play much slower.
Yes, those are
which
helpful.
Must have been a torture for him. And then Cifra checked it, he corrected it, and he did something not very nice to me because there is a trill in the middle part, E-F-E-F, and then he changed it into... And he says, okay, you want to play that? Okay. you come to my show. He had a big show on French television. We used to have a very fantastic show called The Great Chessboard once a month for 3 hours live on prime time on national TV. Once a month, you had one guest of honor. For example, Tzifra or Yehudi Menuhin or Herbert von Karajan with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra or Alexis Weissenberg, you know. And the guest of honor had the right to invite who he wanted. It was going on live on TV in the whole country for 3 hours.
Wow.
At 8:30 p.m. until 11:30 p.m. So he told me, okay, you want to play this? Okay, you come now to my show and you play that. It was in April 75. And I found out recently that some anonymous guy, I would like to know who did that, put this performance of my Bumblebee arrangement by Tzifra, which I played in his presence on that TV show, on YouTube.
Yes, I've seen it.
Somebody put it. Yep. So anyway, that's how it happened, and I will never forget that for this show, Tzifra was supposed to play the Hungarian Fantasy, and he called me in the afternoon, Cyprian, I lost my score, can you bring your score? So I gave him my score, which I never saw again, of course. And that's how it happened.
It's a good investment. Well, we'd love to hear your recording of the Tzifra version of The Flight of the Bumblebee. Just makes you smile. It has such electricity.
You know, Kathy, when I listened to this 34 years later, I played this version as a fourth encore at the festival which takes place in Nohant, N-O-H-A-N-T, which
Chopin's
is the place of
Georges Sand's home.
Georges Sand, exactly, right. The house of Georges Sand. I never played it since then, and I don't smile, I'm terrified.
You know, you looked a little tense when you were listening.
And you know what I like with Tzifra? When he would do a run on the piano, all the other pianists would make a run very academically, you know, like this. And Tzifra would make it expressive, you know, always phrasing, and that's the whole difference.
Is that, well, I mean, the whole concept of virtuosity in its best sense is that a vision is immediately produced. There's nothing in the way.
You are absolutely right. It must always be musical. Whether you play something slow or something fast, it must always communicate a musical emotion. And as you know, music is supposed to express anything from life. So if in a Beethoven sonata, you know, sometimes I remember professors saying, don't have a hard sound, but excuse me, Beethoven himself, when he used to play, he was expressing his revolt or his anger, and you don't think of a beautiful sound. You know, you're not going to do it. You know, revolt is revolt. It's not just beautiful sound. And this is what I would criticize a little bit, for example, with this great conductor, von Karajan. At the end of his life, he was always trying to get a beautiful sound, but music expresses much more than that, you know?
Tell us about this. You have offered to play this piece by Franz Liszt. I think so much of the music of Franz Liszt is explosive as far as the piano is concerned. Suddenly there's a new concept, a new idea, a revolution for the instrument. Well, what is this piece?
Well, the amazing factor with Liszt, at least in my humble opinion, is the incredible, the very vast diversity of the aspects of his music. The gypsy Liszt, the poetic Liszt, the religious Liszt, the romantic Liszt, and there is the avant-garde Liszt. I think he was the very first composer who wrote nearly atonal music. Before Scriabin, before Debussy, you know that Wagner or Mahler even were influenced by the music of Liszt and so many other composers. And it is so unfair that it took so long time to get Liszt recognized as a great composer. I mean, even recently, I hear some stupid comments by some famous pianist saying, Liszt music is worth nothing, you know, it's just ridiculous. No, Liszt was a real genius. And this is one of the late pieces he composed at the end of his life. It's called Trauervorspiel und Marsch in German, which means funeral prelude and march.
We're delighted to hear it. We're live today with Cyprian Katsaris.
Thank you.
That is music of Franz Liszt. Unbelievably, as you say, Cyprian Katsaris, avant-garde
yes.
piece of music.
Although sometimes it reminds me some parts of Parsifal of Wagner, but Liszt wrote this kind of music before anybody else.
It is the Trauervorspiel und Trauermarsch of Franz
Funeral
Liszt.
Funeral Prelude and March.
Right. Franz Liszt's sense of suspense of the long line, of never, ever dropping you from this ever-tightening sort of cord is intense. Do you suppose that he was thinking ahead as far as piano music is concerned in a certain way?
Well, this is a very interesting question, Kathy. I think that when we reach such a high level in the field of the musical composition, we are out of time, out of space, out of matter, and out of physical energy. It's a kind, different kind of energy, the spiritual energy. The reason I believe the music of somebody like Mozart or Bach or Liszt or Chopin will continue to be admired and loved by the audiences and the performance for the next billion years is because they reach something so true. They are very close to the truth. The only true thing, I would say, is the spiritual essence. Some people call it God. Some people call it a kind of energy. Whatever it is, the piano, the hands, the body are just something physical. And the real you, which is located in this beautiful lady's body called Kathy, for example, the real you is something spiritual. It's not just the body, of course. So this is the only, I would say, true thing, because all the other things, all the physical things like the planet, the galaxy, the piano and all that has been artificially created. They have a beginning and ending. But the spirit has no beginning, no ending, has the ability to create all these things. So what I'm trying to say here is that somebody like Mozart or Liszt or Brahms or Tchaikovsky, they reach such a level, such a high level, spiritually speaking, that it is so close to the only true thing, which is the spiritual essence, that it is beyond the physical creations of the spiritual essence, matter, energy, space, time. And this is why it's out of time. It cannot be put in any fashion. It's beyond time. Talking about Mozart, you know the story about this violinist from Belgium who went to Congo when Congo was a Belgian colony. He went with his pianist and they played in a village in front of people who never heard European classical music. And while they were playing, the public was talking, you know, they were making noises. And then suddenly they all stopped talking and making noises. And it was when this violinist played Mozart. Now, what does that mean? That exactly what I was trying to demonstrate before, that the music of Mozart is so at a such high level that it touches at various, of course, degrees, but it does touch very deeply the spiritual being located in those bodies.
Well, since we're talking about Mozart and his ability to tap into what is the space-time spiritual continuum, was he always able to do that from the very, very beginning of his life, do you think?
Well, of course, when he was a kid, the quality of the music was not the same as when he developed. But I have a little surprise for you.
Okay.
If you wish, I can play for you, it's just 1 minute, the three very earliest compositions of little Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart when he was about 5 years old.
Thank you. So sweet. You know, I would have known Mozart by the last one. First one, I think I would have guessed Scarlatti.
Right. But the last one is already great Mozart, right? This one.
And I'm imagining him, I imagine on his keyboard, he was at the outer reaches on both hands, probably
right,
in that
right.
case. sweet
yeah,
music.
It's very, very rare to listen to this music. And there is another one which comes from the Klavierbüchlein, the little book, the little piano book, which is a compilation by the father of Mozart, Leopold, for his sister, for the sister of Mozart, called Nannerl, which is a nickname for Marianne. And there is this little menuet. This piece is interesting because Leopold, the father, wrote at the end of the autograph that that Wolfgang Gerl means the little Mozart, learned this piece one day before his fifth birthday in 30 minutes, within 30 minutes, at 9:30 p.m. So he learned this piece when he was, it was just one day before his fifth birthday, on the 26th of January in 1761, within 30 minutes, at 9:30 p.m., according to his father, Leopold.
Wolfgang heard Leopold play it, and then he played it? Is that
this I don't know.
No. I guess you weren't there.
I tried to get the recording, but I couldn't find one.
We're talking with Cyprian Katsaris, music of Leopold Mozart, a little F major minuet. Well, I was thinking as you were playing that, in a way, maybe it's a good thing that Leopold's imagination wasn't as sophisticated, because in a way I picture little Wolfgang sort of imposing his own imagination on these sort of more basic things that he was surrounded
by. Right, right. Although Leopold wrote some very nice music, and by the way, I made this CD with the three Mozart, the father, the famous, and the son of the famous. And Leopold was a violinist, but he didn't leave any violin piece, sonata or so. However, there are three piano sonatas. One of them I recorded it and played sometimes in concert. And, of course, the famous Toy Symphony. This is an arrangement which was made upon my request by an excellent pianist and composer in New York, Matthew Cameron. And of course, we have the case of the son of Mozart. Now, this is a quite sad story because Mozart got his son Franz Xaver during the year he died in 1791. So he only met the baby just a few months. And Franz Xaver died in 1844 or so. And he was a very, very talented composer. I got some of his music, which is an absolute rarity, through the library in Vienna. And I recorded some of his music. There is a very nice sonata. And also those variations. You know, something terrible happened to him. His mother, Constance, the widow of Mozart, when she introduced him in Vienna when he was 14 years old, which is around the time when he wrote that piece I'm going to play for you, changed his name from Franz Xaver into Wolfgang Amadeus Fies, son, which is a horrible thing to do, you know? And this is the first composition he published when he was only 14 years old. Those are variations on the menuet of Don Giovanni, of his famous father. And I will ask you to please put your attention on the slow variation, the second last one, because strangely enough, it reminds Schubert, except that nobody can say that Franz Xaver copied on Schubert, because when he was 14 years old, when this music was published, Schubert was only 8 years old. So it's quite...
So it was kind of a musical premonition, in a sense?
Yes, strangely. The
Very
Son of
interesting.
Mozart.
Well, these are seven variations on the minuet from the opera Don Giovanni, music by Franz Xaver Mozart, the son of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And we're live today with Cyprian Katsaris.
Thank you.
An astonishing set of variations, 7 variations on the minuet from the opera Don Giovanni. Don Giovanni by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and that is music by Franz Xaver Mozart, his son. I am so grateful that, Cyprian Katsaris, you brought this to us. I've never heard it before. And as you say, in the slow minor variation, he sort of falls into a dream and seems to evoke the future Schubert.
Right, by anticipation. Because as I said before, when he wrote this music, Franz Xaver was 14 years old. We are in 1805, and Schubert is only 8 years old. So it's impossible that Franz Xaver took it from Schubert. And you know the same thing about the Polonaise Mélancolique. Franz Xaver wrote a few Polonaise Mélancoliques, which was
sad Polonaises.
Maybe some musicologists even think that it could have, I'm not going to play all of it, just to show you some excerpts. Maybe he was maybe the inventor, the initiator of the Polonaise Mélancolique. And it sounds totally different than what you just heard. And let me
show you. What year are we talking about here?
We are in 1814, 1815.
Okay.
And there was a little boy called Chopin who was in those years 4 and 5 years old. And excuse me once more, it's impossible that Franz Xaver Mozart copied from Chopin, because Chopin was just a little boy. And look how it sounds.
We're talking with Cyprian Katsaris I noticed that Gramophone magazine has chosen you as editor's choice. Your most recent recording of transcriptions, which I know you love, and Jeremy Nicholas calls you an omnivore, saying that you just love to find beautiful things. And in some cases, they're neglected unjustly. And in some cases, they are just great utterances, which use the piano so beautifully.
The amazing thing of this CD is not me. The amazing thing is that on those 15 transcriptions, 10 of them have been made by somebody I know in Paris who is a great personality. He's Professor Karol Penson. He's a Polish man. He's a professor of physics at the Paris University. And believe it or not, he's the one who made these great transcriptions. There is one of the Recuerdos de la Alhambra of Tárrega. It's a guitar piece, you know, which is... repeat, I do this...
I won't even ask
how you're doing. There is also the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony of Mahler, which sounds great on the piano. Although
like
many musicians will tell you it's impossible because you don't have the continuity of the strings,
sound,
and all that.
But the imagination.
It's a different color, you know?
Sure. Well, this is another of these CDs that one could obtain at CyprianKatsaris.com. I just wanted to remind people, you were born in Marseille, and I know you went to Cameroon for quite a bit of your young life was there.
Yes, because my parents are from Cyprus, Greek Cypriots, and they moved to Cameroon at the end of the 40s. It was a French colony then, and the second largest community after the French one was Greek, to start some business, and that's all. And then we moved to Paris in 59, but I was born in 51 in Marseille because it was not an easy birth. So my mother and my father went to Marseille. We went to Paris in 59 from Cameroon, but I was raised with the Greek language at home and French language because it was a French colony, Cameroon. So I think, you know, the best way to learn languages is when you start very, very young.
You know, there's a couple of great films about you. And when you teach, there is an incredible generosity about your spirit. And I've noticed there's one clip of you teaching a young girl, Chopin
Waltz. Where have you seen
that? That also has made it to YouTube.
Oh.
But this...
You know, I have no computer.
It's a good thing.
I have no mobile
Cyprian,
phone.
I say,
and my friends tell me somebody put such thing on YouTube.
But in the case of this young girl playing a Chopin waltz, which is she's playing it with great dexterity,
yeah,
and very lovingly and, well, beautifully.
Yes.
But you are urging from her a sunniness that she needs and a temperament which isn't there. And I noticed that you asked her to smile.
Well, I believe that the quality of communication is a basic in every aspect of our lives, but especially when you communicate music. You can play perfectly and nothing happens and people get bored, or you can play with some mistakes. You know, I remember Wilhelm Kempf. Wilhelm Kempf, the great German pianist, didn't have such a great technique, but when he used to play a Brahms Klavierstück or a Beethoven sonata, there were some magical moments which I cannot describe. It was like, you know, for the French people, he represented the typical German great tradition of the Germanic music, but he had an ability to communicate so much more than some pianists who play with much greater virtuosity, and you just get astonished but not moved. And that's the whole point, to get moved by the music the performer tries to communicate to you. So if a smile can help this girl, I don't remember what we're talking about, but if this smile can help this girl, why not?
One of the things that has often struck me in, for instance, the music of Beethoven, is a tendency to disintegrate or to be vulnerable. And very often in music which is overly virtuosic, one misses this sense of vulnerability. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I fully understand what you talk about, and you're absolutely right. The vulnerability and the fragility of some musics we perform must be communicated by us. It's our responsibility. And I would like to quote again L. Ron Hubbard, because he's the one who said about the communication that art is a word which summarizes the quality of communication. And the communication aspect is much more important than the technical aspect. I would rather make some mistakes and have some memory problems when I play a concert, but at least to see the satisfaction in the face of the audience. And I remember when I played even Boulez, I don't play anymore Boulez, when I was a kid at the Conservatoire, in the National Conservatory of Music of Paris, my professor, who was a great pianist, Monique de la Bruchollerie, who was maybe one of the very first, if not the very first lady who ever played Rachmaninoff No. 3.
Bruchollerie.
Monique de la Bruchollerie. She asked me to play a music by Boulez, the Scherzo of the Second Sonata. And I think the greatest compliment I ever got was a lady at the end of this student concert. You know, I must have been, I don't know, 18 years old or something. She came and said to me, I never expected that I would like this music. And for the first time, I liked it tonight. And you know why? Because when I played this, I tried to take it as if it was a normal piece by Chopin or Liszt or Mozart or Beethoven. In other words, to put some emotion, not just to do, when you are sincere, you know, in music you cannot lie. In love and music, I think you cannot lie because the listener or your partner will immediately feel it.
That's why somebody once said that all political candidates should be forced to sing a song to the public.
Why not?
Because then you would know if they were lying or not. Could we hear a little of your Chopin?
If you wish.
We have the C-sharp minor waltz, since we were talking about waltzes. This is the Opus 64, number 2. This is also one of your Piano 21 recordings?
Yes, and it's a live performance.
This is a live performance.
At Carnegie Hall, New York City, on the exact day of his anniversary, because Chopin died on 17 October 1849, and exactly 150 years later, on 17 October 1999, I had this In Memoriam concert.
Well, this waltz
was the first encore.
This is the C-sharp minor waltz, Opus 64, number 2, on that very important day in the career, certainly, of Cyprian Katsaris at Carnegie Hall.
Thank you.
Cyprian Katsaris on a very important night at Carnegie Hall in memory and in honor of Frédéric Chopin. That's the Waltz in C-sharp minor, Opus 64, number 2. I'm Kathy Fuller. It's Classics in the Morning on WGBH, and I have the great pleasure of being here with Cyprian Katsaris. So what do you have to tell me about this?
Well, Kathy, if I may give an advice to young pianists who listen to this version of the Chopin Waltz, don't do that in a competition, otherwise they will kill you. They will just cut your head. This is the old way of playing, which is not so easily accepted in our days. And those counterpoints you heard are written. It's all authentic notes in the score of Chopin. But don't try to do that in a competition, okay? Forget it. Forget
you know, there is a wonderful quote from Piano magazine in France, the French magazine, that says that you are far removed from the academic and pasteurized ideals too often celebrated in the present day. And I think that's a little bit what you're talking about, this decision that it is okay to play out the thumb, the line, that the inner line that the thumb has. Your thumbs can play as well legato as any two other fingers. And that is the golden age kind of sound, isn't it?
When you listen to the old recordings of people like Friedman or Rosenthal or Cortot, you know, I think they used to have more freedom and imagination and fantasy. But the important thing is to be yourself, not to try to imitate. Of course, we are all influenced. Everybody is influenced by other musicians, by other pianists. However, as I said before, one cannot lie in music. It's the same like love, you know. So you just be yourself.
But you sit on competition juries, I think, don't you?
I hate it.
Aren't you the one who's? Do you stand up and vote for the guy who's got fantasy in his playing?
I'm trying to avoid being in a jury because there is nothing more difficult than going on stage and playing, and nothing more easy than sitting down and listening and judging and criticizing.
Yeah.
Please don't talk about competitions.
Okay. Well, how about some Gottschalk? Would you be willing to go in that direction for us?
Well, it's getting late in the
time.
Program.
We can squeeze it.
One cannot escape from Kathy.
This is my job. I torture pianists for a living.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Gottschalk was one of the few living people Chopin heard which he liked. He didn't like Schumann. He didn't like Liszt as a composer. He didn't like anybody.
But he liked Gottschalk.
Bellini. He liked Bellini.
He liked Bellini. Yeah.
And, you know, he even wrote an accompaniment for La Castadiva. And he heard Gottschalk, who was a great pianist, a great character. And let me try to give you some banjo.
Okay, some banjo. An incredible piece by Louis Moreau Gottschalk, who really was the first American virtuoso touring pianist, I would say. And we are live with one of the great pianists of our time, Cyprian Katsaris. Thank you.
A tribute to my American friends.
It's such a wonderful piece, and you would never know the technical complications that come with it because it just comes out of you so easily. Now, there was a little bit of Cyprian Katsaris in that Gottschalk.
I'm sorry to admit it, yes. Some
you
arrangement.
You just can't help yourself. Well, tell us more. Give us another sense of your desire to transcribe.
Well, I love transcriptions as much as I love normal repertoire. You know, several years ago, transcriptions were not well seen by some critics or public or whatever. But when you think of what La Fontaine did, you know, the great French writer La Fontaine, he took some of the fables of Aesopos, of the ancient Greece, and he just transcribed them into wonderful modern French language of those years. And he also created his own. In other words, when an idea is great, you can have a prism. You say prism in English?
Prism, yeah.
A prism. You can look it through different lights. And there is this new set of transcriptions I did recently, I mean a few years ago, on Bach. Among them, the Badinerie. Now, the Badinerie, which everybody knows, it's a famous flute and orchestra piece from some suite. I always play the first time of both parts as much as possible close to the text of Bach. And then for the repeat, I do a little variation. And I called it Badinerie en forme de burlesque to make it a little bit more humoristic. And of course, a purist will have the right to object. And I better go to the NASA and find about if I can emigrate to the other end of this galaxy because I might get murdered by some purists for what I have done. Anyway, 3 years ago, I received an email from Marc-André Hamelin, who is, among all living pianists, one of the two or three I admired the most, saying to me, I would like to get a copy of your score. I say, it's impossible to read my autograph. And I didn't want to give it to anybody. I made an exception for Mark. I sent it to him, and I couldn't believe what he did, busy as he is. He just recopied the whole thing so you could read it, you know, which is just a task. It's an achievement. And he was telling me you should get it published by Schott. You know, they have this new series, Virtuoso Piano Transcriptions, whatever they call it. And Schott wrote to me 1 year earlier, and I didn't really answer for 5 or 6 weeks. And then I told them, you forget it because you cannot read anyway my autograph. Then when Mark put it in good reading way, I contacted again Schott. I followed his recommendation. And now it's going to get published.
So here it is. This is a recording of the Badinerie, the à la burlesque by Cyprian Katsaris.
Thank you. you think that the NASA can help me to leave this planet and escape from those possible threats?
There
will be
away?
A fatwa against me.
They're going to come after you. The purists, that's right. It's just a trip.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
So that will be published soon?
Hopefully, yes.
Fantastic. Now, you have another thing that you really wanted us to hear, music of Prokofiev.
Oh, yeah, you know, because on my little label, Piano 21, we have three collections, new releases like the one with the Badinerie, the complete Mozart Piano Concertos Live in Salzburg, and the archives. And we found at the French radio, the only time I played, the only movement I ever learned from the seventh sonata of Prokofiev, the last movement, the Precipitato, which I played when I was 19 years old in 1970 at the École Normale de Musique in Paris, which has been founded by Alfred Cortot. And it was recorded by the French radio. I was a student, and I brought it for you today.
Oh, let's hear it then. This is the final movement of the seventh sonata of Sergei Prokofiev with Cyprian Katsaris. Cyprian Katsaris, a recording made at the École Normale in Paris when he was 19 years old, the last movement of the seventh sonata of Sergei Prokofiev. It's so interesting to hear these recordings that you have been working in your archives, you've been creating new things. You are smart enough, Cyprian Katsaris, to have your own recording label, so you have control and you're not at the whimsy of the larger world, as the larger labels are all sort of disintegrating, I think, at this moment.
You're absolutely right, and I have total freedom, although it's very, very, very difficult because sales are very low and it has costed a hell of money. You know, the money of my fees from concerts go into there, and I always need sponsors. But it's a great satisfaction to be able to find these old archives from either radiophonic sources or some private stuff I have.
Sure.
And
it's your legacy. This is your legacy.
Yes, and you know, to me, the most important thing is the interpretation. I mean, if the sound is not so great or if the piano was not so good, I don't care, because it's something, it's the only performance which was recorded of such piece, and we just published it. You know, this one is a double CD, Russian Music, which also has Tchaikovsky No. 1 Piano Concerto, a Humoresque of Chedrin, and also Rack 3, the famous No. 3 Piano Concerto by Rachmaninoff.
Well, since that is such a tour de force and so beloved, maybe that's how we should end, is by going out with Rachmaninoff. What do you think?
And the orchestra, thank you, Kathy, for your interest. The orchestra, that was done 31 years ago, I believe, in Leipzig, in Eastern Germany, with the Radio Orchestra of Leipzig, conducted by Horst Neumann.
So you were in your mid to late 20s here.
I was 27, yes.
Here it is, Cyprian Katsaris, and this is the end, the great ending of the third piano concerto, the D minor, of Sergei Rachmaninoff. Rachmaninoff. That's the finale of the Piano Concerto No. 3, the Opus 30 in D minor, from a recording of Russian music with Cyprian Katsaris, the pianist. And that was the large Radio Symphony Orchestra of Leipzig and Horst Neumann conducting. Cyprian Katsaris, it has been such an immense pleasure. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you so much, Kathy. It was a great honor for me and pleasure to be in your show here in such a prestigious musical city as Boston.
Bless you.